Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million. And tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
One can only hope the third time is a charm for GMAC. The one-time financing arm of General Motors is now exploring a third taxpayer bailout, and it seems the Treasury Department is agreeable. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It is the 28th of October today. There are all kinds of ways to set up this story. I could say GMAC has to work so GM and Chrysler can sell cars. I could say the government's already so far into Detroit, what's another couple of billion dollars between friends? But maybe the best introduction I could think of is this. Another one? Really? Here's Bob Moon.
Reaction from some financial pundits to this latest hat-in-hand visit to taxpayers has been right out of a scene from Oliver Twist.
Please, sir, I want some more.
Critics want to know why the government won't simply let GMAC fail. They argue it's still burdened with bad subprime mortgages far astray of its original mission, financing cars. But Morningstar analyst David Whiston worries a failure now could still have grave consequences.
GMAC's major importance is that it's the lender to dealers to buy the inventory for both GM dealers and Chrysler dealers, but also for GM and Chrysler customers. And some consumers need a loan through GMAC because they may not be able to get one from another source, such as a credit union or another bank.
At CRT Capital, analyst Kirk Ludke agrees.
If you've already made that decision that you're going to make an attempt to save GM and Chrysler and committed tens of billions of dollars to that effort, it would make no sense to then let GMAC fail.
Ludke points out, though, that more government cash would further tilt the playing field against Ford Motor Credit, which has managed to get by without taxpayer handouts. But Morningstar's David Whiston says it would take more than just another handout to even the competition.
If the world economy comes back, credit gets better for everybody, GMAC, you know, in the future, if they need more money, they can hopefully get it without going to the U.S. government. But the way things are as of today, no one wants to lend money to GMAC other than the U.S. government.
Please, sir, I want some more.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Oh, Bob. A pause now for tomorrow's big news. The recession is going to be over, semi-officially anyway. Unless something goes horribly wrong between now and tomorrow morning, the Commerce Department is going to announce that the economy grew in the third quarter, maybe as much as 2.5 or 3%. That will, though, be small solace to the nearly 10% of the workforce that's out of work and the millions who are still upside down on their mortgages. So our Rico Galliano had just one question.
Who cares about GDP? If our actual lives aren't getting better, why should we care that a number got larger? Diane Swank is chief economist with Mesirow Financial. She says the big number means we've avoided a big calamity.
The best news is that we're no longer particularly in a free fall. It's now become the Great Recession and not a repeat of the Great Depression, although it is still depressing. And I guess, you know, less bad is now good.
But avoiding disaster is not the same as happily ever after. Bill Cheney is chief economist at John Hancock Financial. He's optimistic about the economy, but says this latest growth was spurred by short-term programs that won't last.
The Cash for Clunkers program was a one-time deal that ran out. The home buyer's tax credit, even if it's extended, it still has a short shelf life, as it were.
The secret to a sustainable recovery? Economist Diane Swank says more jobs. Without them, another credit or energy crunch could trigger another dip into recession.
The uncertainty and the risk of having that double dip is still real. That's why no one's popping champagne corks, but they're still drinking lots of cheap wine.
In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
On the list of things that helped start this recession is the collapse of the American real estate market. And so I offer you this news. Once again, the housing market has confounded the experts. Sales of new homes dropped last month. Nobody was looking for a decline because those sales have been rising since March. As Rico alluded to, there is a school of thought that says the looming expiration of an $8,000 first-time homebuyer tax credit is the reason for the surprise, which prompted this question in our morning meeting today. How much does that credit actually help the economy? Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale explains.
The CEO of the National Association of Home Builders, Jerry Howard, figures the tax credit has stimulated more than 150,000 home sales.
Non-extending this is economic suicide. I think we'll go right back into a double-dip housing recession, and the recovery will stall itself out.
Real estate agent Dave Roberts in Sonoma County, California, supports extending the tax credit, but says it's having some unintended consequences.
We have so many first-time buyers looking for homes that they've actually driven up the price of homes at the low end of the market by more than the value of the first-time credit. As people are enthusiastically trying to get the credit, they're probably bidding beyond what the market might have supported otherwise.
Some critics worry that giving low-income people a one-time incentive to be a homeowner will only create more problems down the road.
Owning is not for everyone. That is certainly one of the major lessons of the debacle.
NYU economics professor Lawrence White figures the tax credit is in many cases just a subsidy for people who would buy a first home anyway. Sure, it helps appliance and furniture sales, but he says it's not necessarily cost-effective. The tax credit costs around $1 billion a month, and there's anecdotal evidence the IRS hasn't been able to enforce eligibility rules. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Traders mark the 80th anniversary of the crash of 29 today, mostly by selling. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. New York Yankees take another step on the road to their 27th World Series title this evening. The Fall Classic opens tonight in New York, the Yanks against the Philadelphia Phillies. My sympathies clearly lie with the Yankees, but there is at least one fan out there rooting for both teams. Not that he can't make up his mind, it's just that no matter who's at bat, his company hits a home run. Just one catch, though. Viewers have to be watching in high definition, as Sally Herships explains.
Jack Marucci makes baseball bats in Baton Rouge. He says he started out 6 years ago with a homemade one for his son, and now 30% of major league players use his bats.
And that ball is going to go the opposite way. Jorge Posada, solo homer.
Tonight, Phillies stars Ryan Howard and Chase Utley, and the Yankees' Jorge Posada will swing Marucci bats. And here's the crazy part. Marucci says he hasn't paid a penny to promote his brand.
Because we don't have any marketing. Our marketing has been no marketing.
But his sales are up from last year, way up.
I'd say at least 40 to 45%.
Marucci says TV has been doing all the work for him. Not regular TV, but high definition. HD shows every detail of every play, including a tiny logo on the side of a bat. Once people see major league players using his bats, Marucci says they want to know where to buy one. Bill Glenn is a marketer in Dallas. He says this kind of exposure is hard to get.
There's very little real estate for brands to show their image. If you look at the NFL and the NBA, they're just now starting to look at logos on practice jerseys. And those are practice jerseys, not even game jerseys we're talking about.
Glenn says for sponsors who do find a spot, those deals can cost millions each year. In the meantime, Jack Marucci's baseball bats are getting their airtime for free. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
If you think sales of the iPhone have been strong so far, there are more than 20 million of them in circulation. You ain't seen nothing yet, though. The iPhone goes on sale in China on Friday. Talk about expanding your market. Half a billion Chinese use cell phones. You might think China has already seen some of the benefits of the iPhone phenomenon. Factories there actually make the thing, after all. But those factories are just the first step in a very long iPhone supply and profit chain, as Marketplace's Scott Tong explains.
When you buy an iPhone, who in the world profits? Let's start by ripping the phone open and looking inside.
So the first thing you do is remove those two screws.
Kyle Weens takes apart gadgets for a living. His California company iFixit sells spare parts for computers and cell phones. Weens peeks inside at what he considers the coolest piece of the iPhone, the touchscreen.
And that is a whole bunch, and by a whole bunch I mean hundreds of thousands of little capacitors that are baked into the back of the glass.
The touchscreen digitizer costs Apple an estimated $27 each. It's made by Sharp from Japan. And that country is one of the winners in Apple's global supply chain. So we pause for a Japan moment, courtesy of this Japanese hit song at the Apple iTunes store. Another Japanese firm, Toshiba, supplies the iPhone's flash memory chip. Here's Syracuse business professor Jason Dedrick.
The underlying technology and knowledge and innovation is much more concentrated in Japan because you have companies that have been leaders in a lot of these fields for a long time.
Exactly how much suppliers get paid from Apple is a secret, but Dedrick tries to make estimates. And his best guess is Japanese firms rake in somewhere around 14% of the total profits. That's about one slice out of eight in the Apple pie.
And now I can see what is on the board itself.
Electronics dissector Kyle Weens is now in the inner sanctum of the iPhone, the motherboard. He's looking at a chip with a code number on it.
K2132. And when I see that number, a little chime goes off in my head because I know that K2 marker at the beginning means that it's a Samsung chip.
Samsung from Korea. Oh, baby, no, yeah, yeah. Jason Dedrick at Syracuse thinks Korea gobbles up one or two slices of the profit pie. Now, the one place we haven't talked about yet is China. That's where all the iPhone components around the world come together and get assembled. And it turns out Chinese factory workers only get a few crumbs.
Well, China mainly just gets the wages, and that's really not much. That's probably a few dollars per phone.
About $4 for every iPhone that sells for $300 or more, which leaves a whole lot of pie for the biggest winner. California-based Apple. Dedrick estimates it gets as much as half the profit for every gadget it sells. That's because Apple creates and designs things. That's where the real money is, and the best jobs.
High-level management jobs, engineering, R&D. Apple tends to be very U.S.-centric, so a lot of their high-value activities, they tend to keep pretty close to their home base.
From China's perspective, here's the moral of the iPhone story. The dominant players in the global economy are the inventors and the brand owners, whether it's electronics or cars or clothing. Zheng Chen Ai owns a garment factory in the Chinese city of Wenzhou. He says the Chinese need to move up the ladder in the global economy.
So the next step for us is to build our own brands, but we face challenges. We need more talent, good designers, and more innovation. It doesn't come overnight.
That reality hits home Friday when the iPhone hits the China market, and most of the spoils go to the U.S. of A. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, hear what life is like for the Chinese factory workers who put those iPhones together. Gold prices fell today down to about $1,030 an ounce. Oil was down, the dollar as well. But what really matters when you're thinking about commodities isn't the spot price, what something's trading for right now. You need to watch the trend lines. And those trend lines are talking to commentator David Frum.
Many investors are worried about inflation in the United States. I don't share those worries personally, but it's always wise to hedge. The favorite hedge of the moment is gold, which has spiked to record prices, at least as measured in U.S. dollars. Gold has not performed nearly so well as measured in euros or even Canadian dollars. For me, record price is almost always a sell signal. At almost $1,100 per ounce, gold looks less like a hedge, more like a bubble. By contrast, oil is trading at a little more than half the peak price set last summer. Oil has slumped with the global recession. President Obama's soft line on Iran has also soothed market anxieties about supply interruptions. Still, if you fear the dollar will wither away, you'd think you'd want to put your dollars into a commodity that people actually use, or alternatively, the shares of companies that produce that commodity. During our last inflationary spike, the late 1970s, the prices of gold and oil jumped together. As the inflation threat subsided, both prices tumbled, but gold much faster than oil. An investor who had hedged against inflation with gold would have lost half his or her investment in less than 2 years. An investor who had hedged with oil would have lost less and lost it slower. More time for his or her losses on the hedge to be balanced by the handsome gains that showed up in the rest of the portfolio after 1982. None of this is to offer advice for the future. It's just a reminder that commodities, too, are subject to irrational exuberance.
David Frum is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Take a moment to share your thoughts with us. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says, yeah, you got it, contact. Coming up, what's new about global warming this time?
It's a vastly different type of climate change than anything that has occurred naturally in the past thousands of years. So this scares me.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials dropped 1.2%. That's 119 points on the blue chips. Closed at 9,762. Going backwards here. The NASDAQ fell 2.2%, 56 points. Ended at 2,059. The S&P 500 slumped nearly 2%, 20 points. Closed at 1,042. ConocoPhillips reported disappointing earnings and fell 2.75%. That put the whole energy sector under pressure. Exxon slipped 1.4%. Exploration company Schlumberger slid 4% today. CIT Group had a better day. The troubled lender's shares rose 10% to just over a buck. Imagine that. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-notes fell to 3.41%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. And by Barron's, for more than 80 years providing investors ideas and insights on the markets. Barron's, see what others don't. Barron's.com. Why is a cram down like a slice of cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. It's on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events for Thursday. The Labor Department releases the weekly report on initial jobless claims. It's World Stroke Day, This year's theme is What Can I Do? Currently, strokes are the third leading cause of death in the United States. And on this day in 1960, Cassius Marcellus Clay Jr., better known as Muhammad Ali, won his first professional fight. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. In about 6 weeks, there's going to be a huge international conference on climate change in Copenhagen, Denmark. The United Nations is trying to cajole developing countries and the world's biggest economies to come to some kind of agreement on how to slow down global warming. No easy task, obviously. And the closer the date gets, the more politicians and officials are trying to lower expectations for some kind of deal. That's the backdrop for our series, The Climate Race, in which we explore the economic, the political, and the human dimensions of living on a warmer planet. Today, our sustainability reporter Sam Eaton and Sarah Gardner are going to look at how bad things might get if we don't start breaking our addiction to fossil fuels. And Sarah, to do that, you're first going to take us back a ways?
That's right, Kai. I recently came back from a trip just east of the Sierra Nevada mountains in California.
And Sarah, I hear you were looking at tree stumps.
Right.
Should I be happy I didn't get that assignment?
Well, laugh all you want, Sam, but old dead tree stumps are actually clues to climate past. Listen to this.
These stumps tell us that California is capable of experiencing droughts more profound and more persistent than anything that we've seen during the last 150 years.
Now, that's paleoclimatologist Scott Stein. He looks at past climate to help figure out future climate. And scientists are really interested in this kind of work because if they can understand climate shifts in the past, the hope is that that will help them more accurately project what may be in store for us this time around.
Okay, so back to those tree stumps you were telling us about, Sarah?
Okay, well, I met up with Stein just east of Yosemite National Park. Picture this, you've got 14,000-foot mountains to your west. You've got high desert to your east.
We're on the left bank of the West Walker River, the fourth largest stream on the eastern side of the Sierra.
And what Stein showed me in the middle of this river, and the river is fairly low these days, were these huge dead tree stumps rising out of the water. They look sort of like log spires. He's counted 130 all along the river bottom. If you were driving by, you wouldn't even think twice about them, but some are nearly 1,000 years old.
I would take off a piece about this big right here, and that would be more than enough to radiocarbon date.
So to Stein, these tree stumps are like ghosts of climate past. They're in the middle of a river today, but they couldn't have been when they were growing because trees can't grow in rivers. It floods the root system. So they must have grown when this was a dry riverbed. In other words, during a period of severe drought. And Stein says that drought lasted 2 centuries. He can tell from the tree rings. He's found other tree stumps in the same river that point to yet another mega drought later on. And there's evidence of mega droughts like this all over the West.
Look right over there.
He also took me to the shores of Mono Lake. That's about an hour's drive to the south. Different trees, same climate story.
All right, so what's any of this have to do with future climate?
Okay, Stein says these past mega droughts are warning signs because they occurred during an unusually warm period for the Northern Hemisphere. It gives you a sense of how California reacted to that wider warming trend. Here's Stein again.
It has led a number of us to conclude or at least entertain the idea that it is global warming for whatever reason, artificial or natural. It is global warming that causes California to become very, very dry.
So in other words, we think we've got a drought now in the Southwest. We ain't seen nothing yet.
Right. And that's unsettling, of course, given that today we've got tens of millions of people living in the Southwest. You've got huge cities, major industry, major agriculture, all assuming that the climate and the water supply we have now will stay the same.
Okay, but say I don't believe humans are causing climate change. It sounds like I could easily point to this history and say, look, the climate has shifted in the past, and the shift we're experiencing now is nothing more than just another natural event.
Right, right. I asked Stein that at the end of the day as we were driving back, and he says, yes, there has been climate change before. But he says this time around, we're the ones with our hand on the thermostat, and we're raising the temperatures very, very rapidly.
And therein lies the danger. It's a vastly different type of climate change than anything that has occurred naturally in the past thousands of years. So this scares me.
And other scientists trying to figure out what the climate could be like in the future are worried, too. Some even suggest more severe water shortages in California could eventually make the state unfarmable.
But I can see where people would hear a statement like that and think, how do scientists really know what the future climate is going to look like?
It's a good question. But the first thing people should understand is none of these scientists would ever say with 100% certainty what the future climate will look like. They talk instead about the likelihood of future climate scenarios. And the main tool they use to create those scenarios are computer models.
Right. Basically, these giant computer programs that try to mimic the Earth's climate. On the front end, you have scientists plugging in data about things like the atmosphere, oceans, sea ice, and how they all interact. And then they tweak variables like carbon dioxide levels and see what happens.
Exactly. And this is what I was looking into while you were outside enjoying the Sierras, Sarah. And I can say the scenery isn't nearly as pretty. Some of these climate models run on computers so powerful they take up entire buildings. One of the key people poring over all the data that comes out the other end is a guy named Gavin Schmidt. He's at NASA's Goddard Institute in New York. Here's what he's seeing.
The changes that we're projecting under kind of business-as-usual scenarios are enormous. I mean, they're much, much larger than the changes that we've seen over the 20th century.
Now, business-as-usual, he means if we did nothing to reduce CO2 and other gases.
Right.
So what are these models saying about how bad things could get? We've already heard a little bit about what could be in store for California.
Well, it's pretty sobering. Average temperatures could jump 7 degrees by 2050. Sea level could rise 2 feet by the end of the century. The Midwest could see as many as 3 major heat waves each summer. And the models project more intense rainstorms for the east, storms like the one that flooded Georgia last September. But again, it's hard to say exactly how fast or even if these scenarios will play out. There are just too many variables involved.
But, you know, that's the reason these models have come under so much fire. Sometimes they just don't get it right.
That's true. For example, they miss the mark on air temperatures. They aren't rising as fast as originally projected. In fact, some studies even show temperatures have leveled off recently. And sometimes the models are too conservative. Arctic sea ice, for example, is melting much faster. But other projections like rainfall patterns and heat waves have been dead on. Here's Gavin Schmidt.
Models are not perfect. You know, they're just quantifications of what we think we know, right? They're not perfect representations of the real world.
So basically, these models are only as good as the assumptions that go into them, right?
Exactly. And that's why research like Scott Stein's is so important.
Because the more we understand about past climate shifts, the better the assumptions going into these climate models.
Right. And again, Gavin Schmidt says the issue isn't whether climate models can ever be 100% accurate. It's how much uncertainty are we comfortable with before we decide to act on the information they provide. He likes to use the analogy of a doctor advising an overweight patient to go on a diet. He tells the patient, if you keep gaining weight, your chances of having bad things happen, like a heart attack or diabetes, go through the roof.
Does your doctor know exactly that you're going to get type 2 diabetes if you continue to put on 2 or 3 pounds every year for the next 10 years? No, he doesn't. He is uncertain. And yet, is that bad advice? No, it's very smart advice. And so the climate scientists were in that same position.
And in this case, the advice climate scientists are giving us is we're gluttons for fossil fuels. We need to go on a major diet, right?
Exactly. And tomorrow we'll talk about what that diet might look like and why it might be harder than we think.
There is an interactive map on our website that will show you how climate change could impact your part of the country. There is also a slideshow of those tree stumps Sarah was talking about, not just any tree stumps either. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, more on the topic of free giveaways we explored a couple of days ago with our senior editor, Patty Hirsch. How much he enjoyed that free coupon from KFC for a dinner a couple of months ago. Anyway, Patty came up to me in the kitchen today and he said, "Hey, mate, did you hear?" And I said, "Hear what, Patty?" Well, it seems Boston Market's offering a $1 meal coupon on its website. And just like KFC last May, though, there's more demand for the thing than expected. The offer crashed the company's website, but I am pleased to be able to tell you that Patty got his. And that is Marketplace on this Wednesday afternoon from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 119 points. That's about 1.2%. The NASDAQ fell 56 points, 2.2%. The S&P 500 gave up 20 points, nearly 2% there. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Coming up next time, our series, The Climate Race Continues, on day three, debating how to fuel our economy.
We have been called un-American. We have been called communist because of the fact that we want to bring in wind farms. The coal industry considers that a threat to their bottom line.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.